process, very simply said, says we're going to move away from fossil fuels back towards local livable economies. Mm-hmm. And what does a livable economy mean? Well, that isn't just using renewable energy and providing healthy food, but it's ensuring that every person that lives in that society is able to, without harming nature, mm-hmm. and within living in the limitations of being living harmonious with nature in this technical innovative world, is able to not just survive but thrive. Yeah. And the power structures in our society today and what has come up in this whole surge of this racism discussion and this inequality mm-hmm. discussion is really the fact that people have been surviving and not thriving.
Hi, I'm Tim.
And I'm Stacey.
And welcome to We're Not Doomed,
a podcast all about the human nature crisis that we're facing and what we can do about it in the Caribbean.
Hi everyone, Tim here to give a brief introduction to this week's podcast. As some of you might have noticed, the launch of this episode has experienced a delay of a couple of weeks. We wanted to make sure that the message we share in this podcast addresses the topics we discussed just right. We also wanted this episode to go live in light of the recent events that have been unfolding in our societies across the globe. Yes, we're talking about the issue of racism. Some of you might be wondering why a podcast focused on environmental issues is concerned about racism, and others might be concerned about the anti-racism movement and how it might distract us from our fight against climate change. But have you ever given thought on how these issues are interconnected? Marine biologist Ayana Johnson shares this topic in an article in the Washington Post called "Stopping Climate Change is Hard Enough, but Racism Only Makes It Harder." Also, Leah Thomas, an upcoming social media environmental activist, shared a post on intersectional environmentalism, which has gone viral. She explains, intersectional environmentalism is an inclusive form of environmentalism that advocates for both the protection of people and the planet. It brings injustices done to the most vulnerable communities and the earth to the forefront and minimizes or silences social inequality. Ayana's article and Leah's post trigger the topics discussed in this episode of We're Not Doomed. In this episode, Stacey has an important conversation with Neelam Melwani, an expert on sustainable development, on the concept of intersectional environmentalism and how this philosophy is evolving and slowly but surely being integrated into our societies, even at the level of diplomacy.
Hi, Neelam.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Great.
Awesome.
I'm very excited about this, so thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. I'm super excited you want to have this conversation with me today. Before we go into the topics, could you maybe tell me a bit about yourself, what you do, and so the listeners know who I'm talking to today?
Yeah, definitely. Hi, I'm Neelam, and I was born and raised in Curacao. After that, I lived in several places around the world, working mostly on sustainable development for the government of Curacao, the government of the Netherlands, and also in the UN system. Right now, I'm actually working for the government in the Netherlands, but in this podcast, I just wanted to emphasize the fact that the views that I share are, of course, my own mm-hmm. and are in no way linked to the policies of the Dutch government. And I guess it would be useful to know that my focus is primarily on climate change and the circular economy and how we can build our world better with view to the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development.
Yeah. So could you maybe tell me a bit about how you became involved with the topic or issues surrounding climate change and sustainable development?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's very much rooted to being born and raised on a small island where you're surrounded by water every day. Mm-hmm. When I was 10, I went to my first conference where I presented an idea to save the sea turtles on small island states around the world by having students adopt beaches and clean them up.
Awesome.
Little to know that when I arrived back in Curacao, how difficult and impossible it was to actually enable these policies because most of the beaches were privately owned and made it very difficult for students to even become more involved with keeping the island clean, for example. So after that, I decided that working on making the world a better place for not just people, but for the animals that live here was something that I really wanted to focus on. And I noticed that all these problems transcend boundaries. So it wasn't something that Curacao or any other country would do by itself. And that was the reason I chose a career in international relations and diplomacy.
Yeah, because that's also what I wanted to ask you next. So why did you choose the path of diplomacy and politics and not becoming, I don't know, a conservationist or an activist? Or, you know, there are so many things that we can do when trying to save or better the environment we're living in.
Yeah, I guess it came with the fact that I grew up very much surrounded by the private sector. And I realized very early on that the focus was very much based on money. And I also realized how important government is in making decisions and not just on the high level political side of it that we see on television or when we vote in elections, but a lot of it is how the system works despite political choices, right?
Yeah.
So, and that was something that I really noticed as I moved from Curacao to the Netherlands, for example, where your interactions with government are very different. In Curacao, it's very easy to get in touch with the policymaker or someone that works in government because it's such a small community and it feels so much closer by, whereas the larger the place that you live, the farther and more intangible government seems to feel.
Yeah.
Really on the policy side, right? Because you will still get the same letters from the tax department, or you will still have the same sort of experiences or similar experiences with authorities. But the policy side of how government makes decisions is way farther removed from citizens in a bigger country.
Yeah.
And I was really interested in learning more about that as a student. And I became very intrigued by the fact that governments really needed to work together because the decisions in terms of climate, for example, and then delving right into the topic, maybe, but a decision taken by a country in Europe could have an effect or an impact on a country in Africa or in the Caribbean, right? Because global temperatures and rising global temperatures changes weather patterns, not just by these fake political borders that we've drawn, but those tend to totally disappear and are totally irrelevant when it comes to really tackling climate change. And that was the reason why I decided that enhancing collaboration with governments was something that I really wanted to work on as a young adult. And I knew that when I was 15, and I'm still happy to be doing it now.
Yeah. So, no, that's incredible. We don't come across a lot of people that really know or have a very strong idea of what they want to do and why they want to do it at such a young age. And I just think it's very cool to hear that you had that and that you're actually living that dream or living that desire that you had from a very young age, kind of embodying it now. So that's awesome to hear.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. Well, maybe then, because you already started to make that bridge a little bit to what the challenges are when it comes to addressing environmental and climate issues on governmental or political level. And I think even on a global level, you know, thinking about solutions on what we actually need to do to address these large issues on a, you know, and the role of the government or, you know, the big powers, so to say, the big players in the game. So I think the reason we wanted to have this conversation was very much triggered by, you know, everything that we're dealing with today, not only the pandemic, but also the global, well, at least it seems like a global fight currently against racism. And we came to the conclusion, like a lot of people, I mean, we're not the first ones to say this, but how all these issues, like the environment and our health and our well-being, is interconnected with society and justice and equity, or the absence of equity, I should say, in our society. So maybe you could share a bit about how you've encountered this on a personal level, but also within your work or within your career as a diplomat, being in conversation with all these big political powers in the world.
Yeah. So let me just start by saying that I think that the buildup of events in the world right now from the COVID-19 outbreak and the pandemic around it, and I would honestly call it a crisis around, you know, inequality and racial justice. The systems, the underlying systems that perpetuate and lead to these social injustices and social inequalities in society are the same systems that lead to environmental injustice. Mm-hmm. And that's on a micro scale in a small community to macro scale among countries in the world.
Yeah.
And I honestly think that without really looking at all these topics from a multifaceted lens and trying to bridge the gaps between these policies, we're not going to be able to solve the climate crisis or get closer to that, or really address the social inequalities, because as climate change continues to have an adverse effect on underrepresented populations or populations that are just adversely affected due to location or other factors, as the climate crisis continues to mm-hmm. lead to more to an adverse effect on those populations, we'll start to see a rise in social inequality as well. Countries that are forced to continue to build back better and build back better and build back better without the means to really build resilient economies will continue to face more severe climate threats as this crisis goes on. And that's just a scientific fact. We're going to see stronger storms. We're going to see longer periods of drought. We're going to see weather patterns that we can't control. And an important part of finding a balancing act and that is really addressing the social inequalities. And to bring it maybe back to my work, one of the most mm-hmm. interesting parts of my work was, and something that I've seen, is the development of, you know, these sustainable development goals and the way we as governments choose to look at the goals as a way forward, setting targets for 2030 that could really have an impact on the way our societies are shaped.
Yeah.
And the SDGs, I think, are in many ways, if utilized correctly and if they bring the systemic change that we need, as suggested in the goals in themselves, we would be forced as policymakers, but also as communities, to really look at things from a multidisciplinary intersectional perspective, where you can't achieve SDG 13, which is climate action, without addressing gender inequality, which is SDG 5. So
yeah,
you, right? And this idea of just focusing on one goal or five goals just doesn't work, because the agenda is 17 goals for a reason. And mm-hmm. the reason it's 17 is because all these issues, whether they're environmental, economic, related to inequalities, mm-hmm. related to innovation, they're all interlinked. And it was interesting to be in New York at a time where the goals had sort of just been adopted and mm-hmm. where we started to see a change in rhetoric around the goals, but where we hadn't particularly reached the point where implementation was that far, right? It's clear on so many of the goals that we're not on track to reaching our 2030 targets.
Yeah.
And a huge part of that for this decade, what we need to see is systemic changes and all the things that we're seeing now, whether it's the way this crisis, this health crisis broke out, or the way that these inequalities in societies are surfacing. These are just sort of symptoms of a system that needs to change.
Yeah.
And where the SDGs are a basis for that change.
Yeah. So you were talking about, you know, the development of the SDGs and how they are interconnected, that there's a reason for them being 17, and that makes just, you know, all the sense in the world to me. But I think it's not only, we need to talk about the importance of understanding why we have 17 sustainable development goals, but then you also made a reference on the fact that how we are not anywhere near realizing those goals by 2030, right? So what is going on there, you know? And I think that has a lot to do with, on the one hand, the importance of understanding the history of why we even have these problems in the first place, and what that does, or maybe ignoring that history, and what that does with coming up with solutions, or the willingness to actually achieve those goals that we have formulated as a global entity, I would say.
Yeah. And you're entirely right, right? The 17 SDGs are based on the Millennium Development Goals, which is an interesting construct in itself, because the Millennium Development Goals were only developed for developing countries, mm-hmm. right? The targets set in 2000 were primarily for countries that were lagging, quote unquote, lagging behind in development. Mm-hmm. And what we see in 2015, which I think is quite revolutionary in the fact that it isn't built in a vacuum,
yeah.
right? The 2015 goals are structured in a way where we as communities all have a responsibility to develop, mm-hmm. despite our starting point. So while the goals can be compared in between countries, it's very much based on the progress made
yeah.
in countries. And I think that that's a very important nuance to highlight in the goals, because I think that really underlines what you mentioned, this historical system that can't be ignored.
Yeah.
And, right, it's the whole focus is really on the whole idea is that we can't really focus on one cause and ignore the power structures of another mm-hmm. cause that are lacking in development. And what you mentioned about history is true, right? If we go back to the way the world looked prior to the 20th century, even, we're looking at power structures that we thought had been entirely dissolved with the founding of the United Nations, with the dissolving of colonial relations in the Trusteeship Council. But what we're actually seeing is that the power dynamics didn't entirely dissolve, they just
yeah.
shifted. And it would be, I think, naive for us to look at the current state of the world today and consider the SDGs and not consider the history that brought us here.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think that one of the reasons why some of the root causes are of these issues are not addressed today is because there is a limitation in the way we consider the historical impacts
yeah.
of crises and of the past, like of the events of the past on the situations we're in
yeah.
now.
And what kind of consequence does that have when we are talking about, okay, implementing the Sustainable Development Goals or taking the measures required to achieve those goals?
So I think what we're not considering with the goals is that some countries are, based on their historical situations, mm-hmm. they're unable to plan to achieve a 15-year deadline,
right.
right? Like, it's way more, I mean, I have an issue considering Maslow's Maslow's hierarchy or pyramid on a global scale, but in some ways it's true. If societies are not able to address their current needs, their mm-hmm. physiological needs, their safety needs, then there's a vision that they're unable to then focus on these 15-year long-term yeah. goals. That's also the framing of these goals in the long term, because actually the goals should boil down to addressing the physiological and safety needs in society. Yeah. But a lot of it is just framing the problem differently.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. I think, and I'm also thinking about framing and where we are coming from, and again, going back to history. And I think it says a lot about the framing of the goals, but also in that there's a need to kind of completely restructure our own views and perspectives on how, not only in how we are going to achieve these goals or, you know, what limits us, but also just in general, you know, how, what the relationship that we have with the environment looks like and where that is coming from, you know, what that is based in. And that, I think, brings you back to history. And that's also something we talked about earlier or in previous conversations, that, you know, a lot of what we're doing today, a lot of what's the way society is structured today comes from a view that is, well, for a lack of better terms, you know, from the global north, which is based in a vision of discovery, which leads to exploitation, right? So going to places, discovering them, going to new places, and then coming up with ways on how to exploit them. And I think that has disrupted the, you know, our relationship with the environment, that it's no longer part of us, but that it's seen as a resource, you know, and that, that makes it very distant from who we are as human beings and what our responsibility or role or, yeah, our relationship is with the environment. And I think that also translates a lot into the social inequalities that we're viewing, you know, who had the power to exploit or who was exploiting and who is now faced with the consequences of exponential exploitation of resources in that few. And how do we shift that mindset back to something that is more holistic or sustainable for all of us?
Yeah. I think, you know, what you just said, it really triggered me, that we see nature as a resource. Mm-hmm. And that's true. And that's very deeply rooted in the fact that previous worldviews were very much based on exactly what you said, right? Discovery, extraction, economy, and then exploitation. And there are economies that are entirely built on that mm-hmm. model. And shifting those economies back towards nature, yeah. right? To living in harmony with nature is a process. And what I had to think about was then this idea of just transition, right? That is essentially what I really like about using the term just transition is that it really focuses on the process of how to get yeah. there and not just the outcome. Yeah. And the process, very simply says we're going to move away from fossil fuels back towards local livable economies. Mm-hmm. And what does a livable economy mean? Well, that isn't just using renewable energy and providing healthy food, but it's ensuring that every person that lives in that society is able to, without harming nature, mm-hmm. and within living in the limitations of being living harmonious with nature in this technical innovative world, is able to not just survive, but thrive. Yeah. And the power structures in our society today and what has come up in this whole surge of this racism discussion and this inequality mm-hmm. discussion is really the fact that people have been surviving and not thriving.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also the power structures that we have today are also inhibiting us from thriving.
Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely, right? And those are things just like climate change, these are power structures that transcend borders. Yeah. And that's what makes this movement so powerful, I think, is because it's just another eye-opener, at least for me, in terms of my work, and the fact that so many of the issues we face are not going to be issues that one country is going to be able to solve in itself. Yeah. And of course, issues take different shapes and have different tones and have different outcomes, right? And of course, local and national governments need to take the steps to enforce or to change the legislation and enforce different rules and laws to change the system. But at the end of the day, a first realization that the same structures that cause social injustice also cause environmental injustice, and the fact that they transcend borders, that's something that has really come to light on in these past couple of months, whether it's dealing with COVID or addressing inequalities in our society.
Yeah. I'm also thinking of thinking of politics, but also diplomats in a general sense of the word, and what they can do to bring this insightful way of, like, kind of the way you've been formulating it right now and the insights that you've been gaining. What would be something that we could do as a society to kind of accelerate that process within those higher spheres? Do you think there are ways that we can help there, or actions that we can take to kind of accelerate that acknowledgement, but also the willingness to take action in a different way than we've done previously?
Yeah, so definitely, right? I think, and now reverting back to the SDGs, these are sort of my mantra, I guess. Yeah. But what is also unique about the goals is they're written from a whole of society approach. So it's not just government action that's going to have us reach the goals of the 2030 agenda, right? A lot of it is thinking locally. A lot of it is the private sector ensuring that the goals their business sets are aligned with the sustainable development agenda. Like, how do we change our business models in the private sector, whether it's a small and medium-sized enterprise to a large corporation? How do you ensure that the products you make are not being built to be replaced, or are not being used to be replaced, but are being designed to be reused, being designed to last longer? And how do we as citizens, what are we as citizens demanding from our companies when we buy a product? And those are simple things, I think, in terms of the climate side, and also the way we use resources and sustainably consume and produce. But that also goes to say, in terms of inequalities, right? Like, I think what this whole period has showed us, and why I think it's interesting to see how the protests and this whole discussion sort of started in the midst of a pandemic, gives us the time as people to reflect on the power structures that we've been, as individuals, that we've been keeping in place, or that we haven't been challenging.
Yeah.
Because that's essentially what's needed, right? That we look at these power structures differently and think about our roles in these structures, and how we have been perpetuating these structures rather than challenging them, even if we maybe felt that we should have.
Yeah, exactly. So a term that is being used a lot these past days is intersectional environmentalism. And basically what the term coins is that, you know, you should not look at the environment as a sole thing or as a sole entity. It is connected to everything that we have just discussed in the past, you know, half hour. I'm saying how it's linked to all these social and, global issues that we're facing. It's not just one thing in itself, and that is also not the way that we should view it or address it. And it's a term that really resonated with me for several reasons. One is because I've been saying this for as long as I can remember, you know, even with my own background in environmental psychology, always saying, well, you know, it's about the people as well. It's not just about the ecology of biology of things. Of course, that's important. That is kind of the technical part. I tend to say, like, those are the technicalities of what is happening within our environment. But really understanding the root of it, it's going back to the people and the societies that are shaping the environment and that are linked to the environment. And as something else that came to mind, the fact that this term intersectional environmentalism kind of boosted gained a lot of attention over the past couple of weeks is that it had to do with racism. And then I was also thinking about my own role and my own position within the entire environmental debate. And something that I noticed within my own career is that there is this idea that, you know, environmental issues are white people issues, that they're not something that other societies or other people should be addressing, which is just, for one, it's just not true, because we are all here concerned about what is going on within our environment. But I think that has a lot to do with representation as well, right? So what we see and how the issue is being framed and who has the voice or who has certain spaces when talking about these issues. And I don't know if that is something that you've noticed as well, you know, for example, in New York, when the Sustainable Development Goals were formulated, or in different environments that you've been in yourself, like, what does that look like? You know, who are kind of the faces of addressing environmental topics or addressing environmental issues? And who do people generally see as the ones responsible for causing the problems, but also addressing them?
So that's a tricky question, because it's a lot of questions rolled into one. Maybe it would be good for me to start on the country representation level. So In terms of diversity, I think most countries are represented in discussions, but it's obviously based on their capacity and on the priority set by their capitals.
Yeah.
So a permanent mission of a country that only has one diplomat or one ambassador there is less likely to engage as broadly, of course, than a permanent mission with more staff members on every topic. So that's an issue in representation that we do see at the UN as well.
Yeah.
What I do think in the broader, right, environmental world is indeed that Black, Indigenous, and people of color are often underrepresented. There's research to prove this as well. And for me, that's problematic also within the frame of intersectional environmentalism, but at the same time I think there's two reasons for that, and one of the reasons has come to surface today, right? How do you as a person or society deal with different existential crises at one time? There was actually an article on the New York Times. I think you shared it on your Instagram as well, where, right, if a Black, Indigenous, or person of color is trying to deal with a different existential threat based on their inequality and socioeconomic position in society, then the climate crisis may seem farther away. Yeah. While for the people who study it and know it, the impacts are looming, they're not as in your face all the time.
Yeah.
As socioeconomic injustice may be.
Yeah, but at the same time, for what we were saying in the beginning of this issue, at the same time, the consequences of, you know, industrialization and exploitation and just, you know, the imbalance that we are, the way that we are treating the environment, let's just leave it at that, the consequences are most strongly felt by often people of color.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people, and I think it becomes an issue of race because it's so tied to social class. I think social class is kind of even more prominent in this issue, but then you cannot deny the topic of race, because race, especially in certain countries, has been linked to class. So those two are absolutely interlinked. On the one hand, those people or those communities are faced with a the most consequences or the biggest consequences. But because they are dealing with so many issues at once, sometimes it seems as though they are not, you know, they don't engage in these environmental debates either. But I don't know, I don't think that's completely true. I think maybe those people are the most concerned with these issues, but they don't have the means to kind of, you know, reach the ivory tower, we say in academia, to kind of voice their opinions and their thoughts and their concerns, you know, among certain levels.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with you. And I also, but what I also think is that you are more concerned. So just to make it tangible, if you a farmer that lives off the land and you've been blessed with an area with sufficient rainfall for your crops for years, and all of a sudden the past 5 years, your crops are at risk, which is your subsistence form of living, because of a drought. The primary instinct that I think people have in that situation is to zoom in on the problem of the drought and therefore not have time to think of the larger threat at hand. And that's a structural issue that's indeed linked to socioeconomic class, because if your subsistence living is being threatened, then you are looking for solutions to that smaller problem rather than seeing the broader climate crisis as an existential threat that needs to be addressed on a macro level. Yeah. And that in itself is a socioeconomic issue that we need to be better about understanding and realizing, and just as a population as a whole and as people. Right? And this sort of comes back to what I had said earlier about how I sort of want to use Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but the fact that I think it's sort of outdated is because a lot of these, the existential threat of climate change is not brought across as that in societies. It's sort of, oh, deal with the drought now, but we'll just not zoom out to the bigger issue. Where actions actually need to be taken to avoid that drought happening later.
Why do you think that is? That we're not zooming out.
Well, I think for the person addressing the drought, they're not in a situation where they're able to zoom out at that moment because their thoughts are very much based on providing subsistence living for them and their families.
Yeah,
and I honestly do think there has been a shift on a higher policy level where we are zooming out more. And that's why you see things like the SDGs. That's why, that's why we were able to reach agreements like that of Paris. But I think the implementation is where we struggle because all of these changes in society require a different system. It requires us to look at the world differently, and that's not something that's going to happen overnight, which is why I think this idea of intersectional environmentalism is so important, and the idea of thinking about it as a just transition is even more so important because it really focuses on the process of getting from where we are today, not just in terms of this consumer-based fossil fuel economy, linear economy that we're that we're in right now, but really the transition to a world where people are thriving and living harmoniously with nature, right? And this broader sense of where we want to go means tackling all these power structures and systems that have perpetuated our lives for centuries and rethinking the way they come together to make our world more equitable and more sustainable.
No, I mean, it's going to require such a big mind shift, and not only mind shifts, also just, you know, the way that we are living needs to change completely. And that is absolutely scary. I mean, if there's one thing we know about people, and I think I can speak for the both of us, is that we hate change. We don't, you know, we don't want to change. Well, sometimes we love it, but when it comes to kind of, basic fundamental things, you know, living in certain types of housing, you know, having certain comforts or luxuries and being willing to give that up. Yeah, that's something that's going to take time for people to be willing to do or to accept to do. And, you know, and it's also going to take time to rethink, you know, what that new reality or that new relationship should look like. Like, does it inherently mean that we can no longer have certain buildings or comforts, or does it mean something yeah. else, right? So I think there's also a big mountain of work in that respect itself. It's not just drastically changing and all living in tiny houses yeah. and in small communities and everybody growing their food on their balcony, which I think is fantastic. But I don't know if that is going to be the solution for everything. I think it's also rethinking more, you know, going even more in depth of what that new reality or new way of living and society should look like. And that is where the challenge lies. You know, that's the thing that's complicated, maybe.
Definitely. And that's why I think the period we're in right now is so unique, because I think for the first time in a long time, citizens are rethinking the systems in our society.
Yeah.
And whether that was how this pandemic spread or the way people are treated in societies, it didn't matter, because we're all really thinking about the way our systems need to change. And I hope that we are able to take the next step and really make that link with the fact that all these systems are so interconnected. Yeah. And we can't look at social injustice without looking at climate anymore. That's a luxury we just don't have.
Yeah.
And right, the climate movement among the youth in recent years is very intrinsically linked to justice.
Yeah.
And the exact same justice is sort of the underlying cause of the uprisings and the protests now in terms of racial injustice.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're sort of, as a population, getting to a point where we are noticing the links between all these different inequalities, and that's why I think we're so lucky that there is technically already an agenda in place to address these, if only we are able to embrace this as a solution.
I'm also thinking a bit about, you know, the ways to implement the sustainable development goals, and what I've been, you know, observing a little bit over the past couple of years is that I'm kind of just repeating myself and you a little bit right now, but that the process of implementing them and finding ways on what is the right way to do it, that's an interesting thing to follow in itself. You see companies and countries kind of viewing the sustainable development goals as boxes to tick. So, oh, here, check, we've done this and we've done that. Or they are coming up with kind of shortcuts in how they can show that they are meeting the sustainable development goals. But what I really hope is that we are indeed working towards, that we also remain critical towards the sustainable development goals, and not so much the goals in itself, but again, more in the implementation of it. Like, when are we supposed to be satisfied? I think it's good to have a deadline or something to work towards it. But I think the danger in that is that, you know, you see things happening that I just mentioned, that there are countries and companies and places kind of just using them as boxes to tick off or to improve their economic or their social or societal status within the, you know, within global sphere. So that is something I suppose we need to remain critical of. And when really working towards these new systems or realities for us.
Definitely. And I think the most important part of what you just said is that these aren't just boxes to tick, right? And I'm curious to see what the world will look like in 2030.
Yeah.
Because if we as countries are just ticking boxes, then I think what I view as the intrinsic right? The intrinsic need and the intrinsic value of the goals could become lost in translation.
Yeah.
And that's something that we as citizens also just need to be conscious and wary of.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking if I have any more questions right now. I'm always like really fascinated with this topic, and I always notice that my mind is kind of going all over the place in things that I've experienced myself or have observed. And what I would like is for the listeners to kind of think critically themselves about the topics that we just discussed or we just talked about. And maybe there's a couple of takeaways we can share with them, what they can do in their daily lives or just in their thinking to collectively or to join the collective to working towards a more harmonious and better environment for all.
Yeah, key takeaways. So I think the first part is to really use the momentum that there is now to address socioeconomic and racial injustices to also see that in a broader perspective.
Yeah.
And I've heard some very worrying things also about the climate crisis the past couple of months in terms of, oh, well, now that the focus is on, our focus should be on healthcare, our focus should be on addressing racism individually rather than looking at things from a broader perspective and understanding the power structure. So I think one of the key takeaways for me is, and something honestly that I've very much realized the past couple of months is how interlinked these issues are, and that the same way we're educating ourselves on the history with regards to racism and how we can positively bring this discussion forward by actively being anti-racist, it's also a question of how do we bring the climate crisis forward by being more aware of the environmental root causes and the ways we are perpetuating issues and how we can help resolve them.
Exactly.
I think that's definitely one of them.
Yeah. And I think just to add to that a little bit, because I think what I also noticed in my direct environment is that all of a sudden there was a fear that we no longer have the space now to talk about climate or environmental issues. Whereas, and that is kind of where the term intersectional environmentalism popped up in saying, well, but all these things that we're talking about, they are so connected that there's a really big importance in acknowledging that and seeing that, and that one debate does not automatically or does not ever dismiss of the other. Yeah, maybe it redirects the wording that we're using or kind of maybe a little bit of the focus or the emphasis that we're placing on the issues. But at the end of the day, these things are one and the same almost. So, So to kind of train our minds to view it, to view all these the big global issues or the inequality issues as one.
Yeah, and we really live in an issue-driven world, right? We live in a world where, like the locust crisis in West Africa isn't on the news, or in East Africa, isn't really on our news, in our direct vicinity, even though people are being adversely affected by that as well.
Yeah.
And zooming out of this issue-driven world to a more broader perspective of how everything is interconnected and interlinked is indeed actually possible now because the information is out there.
Yeah.
And we do have access to it.
Yeah.
And we're lucky we do, at least where we are in the world and with the resources that we have. And I just think it's so important to be able to actually zoom out and to address inequalities in a broader perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And did you have a second takeaway?
Yeah, I guess for me, the second takeaway is taking responsibility and actually understanding the root causes. I think that is something that we really need to work towards.
Mm-hmm.
And those spaces do need to be created, and we don't see them often.
Yeah.
I think that that's the crux, right? Once you've educated yourself on the broader inequalities and the way forward with sustainable development, then the second step is indeed creating spaces where we can have those conversations with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be not just government to government. That has to be citizen to citizen. That has to be person to business. That has to be in all layers of our society, and even more so in the way we teach our kids later or now on how to look at the world and deal with the issues. And it will be interesting to see how the next generation looks at some of these issues that are really permeating our society today, and really bringing out some of these deep divides to the surface, to see how they would react, right? Because I think a lot of the things that are happening now are just the beginning of the systemic changes that we need.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Yeah. Well, we talked a lot about, you know, just how things are interconnected, and that we shouldn't be too discouraged. They are linked to each other, and addressing one will also have implications for the other. I think that is
kind of the gist. Oh, I do have another takeaway. I remember it now.
That we can share.
Okay, so my third takeaway from all of this is patience. I think we need to be patient with each other. I think we need to create the space where we all feel safe to express our feelings and change our opinions. I think we need to be patient with our governments when it comes to changing systems. I think, and I think the word just transition says it all. It's a journey to where we need to be as societies. And I know that in some cases, patience is a luxury, but in terms of really, and especially with some of the things that are happening now, patience really is a luxury. Some things need to be addressed immediately, but this whole route towards sustainable development and just transition is really something that is going to require a lot of change from all of us. And that also requires us to be patient and understanding of one another. And I don't think we say that enough. I don't think we listen enough. I don't think when we listen, do we actually hear? Are we actually not just listening to react, but to understand? And I think that that's, for me, one of the biggest takeaways, and something that I really learned during this pandemic. I think being surrounded by so much silence, that I really started to listen more, and that there's so much you can learn by just doing that.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is something you just mentioned yourself as well, is that in addition to having patience and, you know, growing our ability and willingness to listen, and understand more, I think we also need to work on, you know, creating some kind of cultural change in allowing for our opinions to change or evolve over time. The more you know, and then that it should trigger you to maybe think differently about situations, differently than we've all done before, and that is okay. That is okay to think differently and to have a change of views depending on the information that you have. So I think those three things really go together beautifully in creating space to have patience, to listen, but then also creating the space to evolve with the new information and insights and, you know, knowledge that we have and understanding that we have.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to end this as well.
Awesome.
To conclude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me too. Awesome. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you so, so, so much for giving your time and sharing your experiences and insights with us. At the end of the day, I think we can agree that we are all working towards similar goals, and that it is up to all of us to continue to do so to achieve them at the end of the day.
Thanks so much for having me. And indeed, right, all these, so many of these issues transcend boundaries, and we really need to work towards a world where our solutions do as well. Yeah. Thanks. It was lovely to speak to you and have this conversation. So looking forward to keeping in touch too.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
All right. Too. Well, enjoy your weekend. Take care. And we'll speak soon.
We hope you enjoyed and learned something from this episode. We've provided links to the articles mentioned in the description for further reading. And don't forget to subscribe. And until next time on We're Not Doomed.